She believed her medication was sorcery and witchcraft, and therefore it was evil.
Mental illness can have a profound impact on a family, affecting various aspects of relationships, communication, and overall well-being. They can exert strain on interpersonal connections, and in 2011, the question of mental illness within a family raised questions as detectives scrambled to investigate the shocking murder of a mother. Highland Township is located 30 miles northwest of Detroit in Michigan. It's a suburban area renowned for its blend of residential and rural charm. The area boasts a diverse landscape characterized by lakes, wooded expanses, and open spaces. Nestled on the outskirts is Burwood Court, a picturesque residential neighborhood enveloped by woodlands. This was where the Pine family made their home. Ruth and Bernard were married for over 30 years, and they were the pillars of the Pine family. Their household included two children, Jeffrey, who was born in 1990, and Julia, who was born a decade later. Before embracing family life, Ruth was a 1977 graduate of South Leon High School. She and Bernard had crossed paths in the 1970s while working together at a hardware store. Ruth and Bernard were exceptionally proud of their two children and wanted the very best for them in life. Jeffrey's educational journey unfolded at West Highland Christian Academy, a private school that saw him from kindergarten through to the 12th grade. At this institution, he earned praise from Christine Lapeer, his Christian music teacher. She described Jeffrey as hardworking, excellent academically, outstanding in athletics, and always respectful. In high school, Jeffrey was valedictorian of his class. Then in 2008, WXYZ, a local TV station, recognized him as one of the brightest and best high school seniors. After his graduation, Jeffrey embarked on a pre-medical program at the University of Michigan Flint, nurturing aspirations of becoming a chiropractor. To support his college endeavors, he worked at Spicer Orchards. At 21 years old, Jeffrey continued to live at home with his parents and younger sister. His father, Bernard, worked every day to provide for the family, while Ruth was a stay-at-home mother, ferrying Julia to and from school. Ruth was best known for her strict yet protective demeanor. She had temporarily barred Jeffrey from playing basketball in his junior year to prioritize his studies at school. It was a decision that proved successful, as Jeffrey maintained a 4.0 GPA. Aside from managing the household, Ruth found solace in handcrafts such as crochet and cross stitch. She liked to lounge around their swimming pool, reading, and taking walks with her husband Bernard throughout the neighborhood. It was a cool spring afternoon in Highland Township on the 27th of May 2011. Ruth and Jeffrey were at home while Julia was at school, and Bernard was at the Highland Hoist restaurant. He was there to celebrate the retirement of a former employee named Jake. Bernard arrived at the restaurant at about 11:45 a.m., and the small group had lunch together before leaving at about 2 p.m. Jeffrey had work at 3 p.m. that afternoon, and Bernard was picking up Julia from school. He pulled up outside the school, and Julia hopped into the car before they drove back home. Once home, Bernard went outside to take the pool cover off for a swim. Moments later, however, Julia came running out of the garage, repeatedly screaming "Mum" and pointing towards the garage. Bernard immediately stopped what he was doing and rushed over to the garage, assuming that Ruth had somehow hurt herself when they were out. He tried to push open the door of the garage, but it appeared to be blocked by something. As he peered through the small gap, he saw Ruth's bloody hand splayed out on the garage floor. With urgency, Bernard barged his way into the garage, and his eyes were immediately drawn to the corner where the door was. Ruth was lying on the ground surrounded by a puddle of blood. Her hair was matted with blood, and part of her brain was exposed. Overcome with emotion, Bernard began to scream, alerting their next-door neighbour, Dave Gilbert. As Dave made his way over to investigate the commotion, Bernard called 911 on his cell phone. He was in a state of shock and found it difficult to articulate the situation for the 911 operator. He wasn't entirely sure what had happened, but he knew that his wife was dead.
911, where's your emergency?
My wife, she's laying in the garage. There's blood everywhere. I don't know what's going on.
In the background of the phone call, Julia could be heard whimpering and crying. As Bernard struggled to speak with the 911 operator, Dave peered his head into the garage. Bernard handed him the cell phone as he struggled to speak. After a brief moment of surveying the scene, Dave said to the 911 operator, "Oh God, it doesn't look good." The 911 operator dispatched officers to the scene, with Oakland County Deputy Michael Sale arriving first. Upon arrival, he was greeted by Bernard, Julia, and two concerned neighbours, all gesturing towards the garage where Ruth's lifeless body lay. Squeezing through the garage door, he confronted the scene before him. Bright red blood, a gaping hole in Ruth's skull, and the absence of her shoes. Systematically combing through the house twice, he ensured that there were no additional victims, or the presence of a potential killer. Noting the dead-bolted front door and the absence of anyone else inside, he swiftly coordinated the dispatch of paramedics to the scene. Amy McIntosh, a paramedic, arrived promptly and was escorted into the garage. At 2:58 p.m, she pronounced Ruth dead. It was evident that Ruth was the victim of a frenzied assault. Outside, Bernard and Julia anxiously waited in the back of the ambulance. Bernard urgently called their son Jeffrey, who was at work, and told him he needed to come home immediately. As Amy delivered the heart-wrenching news to Bernard and Julia that Ruth was dead, both were overcome with inconsolable grief. Bernard was evidently tormented by guilt and repeatedly uttered, "If I would have stayed home, this wouldn't have happened." Jeffrey hurried home from his job, joining his father and sister in the ambulance. Informed of his mother's death, he expressed, "I was just here at 1:30. Over at the medical examiner's office, the grim reality of Ruth's death unfolded. The autopsy revealed a brutal assault, with Ruth enduring 13 or 14 blows to the back of her head with an unidentified object. She was then turned over and subjected to 16 stab wounds to the neck. The presence of hemorrhaging in these wounds suggested that Ruth's heart was still pulsing when the stabbings occurred. The fatal culmination of her injuries included the combination of stab wounds, blunt force trauma to the head, and a crushed skull. Returning to the crime scene, observers noted Jeffrey emerging from the ambulance, visibly distressed. He dropped on his hands and knees and began to moan loudly and dry heave. After a while, Amy the paramedic offered to check the blood pressure of Bernard, Jeffrey, and Julia. They all agreed, but while getting their blood pressure taken, Jeffrey showed the paramedic some bandages on his hands and asked if she could help to change them. Beneath the bandages, blisters were revealed. Jeffrey explained to the paramedic that he had sustained these injuries while handling a pallet at work. Crime scene investigators swiftly descended upon the home, meticulously scouring every inch for clues that could lead them to a suspect. The clear focal point was the garage, where the blood evidence indicated that Ruth had been attacked and killed here. Blood spatter adorned the garage door, cement walls, and various objects, suggesting a violent struggle. Ruth was repeatedly struck in the head, either as she fell or lay on the garage floor. Afterwards, she was turned over and stabbed multiple times in the neck. Detectives began to look into the possibility of who killed Ruth. Initially, they entertained the theory of a botched robbery, but they soon discarded this notion as the examination at the home revealed no signs of forced entry. The orderly home also lacked any signs of ransacking. Ruth's belongings, including her purse, cell phone and money, remained undisturbed on a living room table, in clear view. Amid the absence of stolen valuables, Bernard observed a missing 2x4 board, prompting speculation that it could have been used as the murder weapon. It was normally kept in the garage where Ruth was found. but now it was absent. While the garage emerged as the primary crime scene, a curious discovery in the laundry room piqued detectives' interest. Detectives found Ruth's blood on the sink handles, suggesting that the killer took the time to wash away evidence. Detectives expanded their search to the surrounding neighbourhood, seeking any potential evidence that might lead them to the killer. They meticulously combed through ditches, fields, and diligently checked every bin and drain. As the broader investigation unfolded, the Pine family was transported to the police station for interviews. During Jeffrey's interrogation, detectives honed in on him. They had learned from the paramedic about the injuries to his hands, and this combined with a lack of forced entry led them to believe that the killer was somebody with access to the home. When he came into the police station, they noticed that he was carrying a lock blade knife in his front pocket. Detectives immediately confiscated it and handed it over to forensic specialists for further analysis. Jeffrey was then ushered into the interrogation room. In response to questioning, Jeffrey recounted his morning routine.
So today, let's get back to today. So today you said you got up around 10?
Yeah, about 10.
All right, what did you do when you got up?
Had breakfast, got on the computer. Didn't really do a whole lot. She got home from grocery shopping, and I helped her bring the groceries in and put some of them away. And
where'd she go grocery shopping in India?
Meijer.
Was she home when you got up, or was she already gone?
No, she was gone. Okay. She got back, I don't know what time it was, like 11:30 or noon, something like that.
He said that he assisted his mother in bringing in the groceries and putting them away. Jeffrey said that after his mother went upstairs to rest, he left the house to fulfill an odd job for a local woman named Diane Needham, involving the relocation of a lilac bush. He claimed to have completed this errand at about 3 p.m, before heading to his job at Spicer Orchards, where he was when his father called him. Jeffrey was then informed that his mother wasn't just dead. She had been the victim of a murder.
Jeff, see, you have no idea how your mom died or anything.
No.
Okay. Your mom was murdered. Someone killed your mom. Okay, it's not an accident. We need to get to the bottom of it. Okay? So if there's anything else that you know about that you've been holding back, that you're afraid to tell us, now's the time. Okay?
I don't know what to tell you. I don't know if anyone who would want to hurt her.
Detectives delved into Jeffrey's hand injuries, and he said that he got them at work, where a pallet slipped from his grasp.
What's wrong with your hands?
This was from work today. I was flipping over a pallet on my way to check the bathrooms, and as I was flipping it over, my hand got caught in there and just tore off the skin.
Can I see it? I mean, can you not do that?
I can kind of pull it back a little bit and see it just rip the skin right off.
Let me see. I don't want to.
Yeah. It kind of stings when you push on it. I'm just trying to keep it covered up, so.
It almost looks like a blister.
It just tore the skin right off. There was, like, skin hanging on it, and I just, like, peeled it off. Washed my hands, put some alcohol swab on it, so.
I mean, I've moved a lot of pallets before, and I've never, you know, where the wood grabs you, you might get a slip or something, but I've never had an injury from a pallet like that.
I was tossing it on there, my hand got caught, and I just pulled back.
Okay, was anybody else there helping you move those pallets at all?
No, I was on my way to the bathroom.
However, the detectives harbored suspicions. They thought that the injury seemed consistent with wielding a board, resembling the missing 2x4 from the family's garage. The detectives also observed some light scratches to Jeffrey's arms, but they weren't concerned about these.
Did you have any altercation with your mom today?
No, not at all.
No type of fight, no type of argument, anything.
We didn't even argue today.
You say that you left at 1:30. Can anybody verify that you left at 1:30? How can we verify that?
I don't know.
Are those scratches on your forearm, sir?
These, yeah. I get scratched up a lot from work. This was a goat got out of the pen, and we had to catch him.
A goat?
Yeah, we have a petting farm.
Your mom is a stay-at-home mom. From information we've gathered, does not have a bunch of friends. She doesn't have any enemies. Why would somebody pick your home in a very short time period and harm your mom?
I don't know.
Jeff, I'm going to ask you a tough question here today.
Okay.
Did you do anything today at all to hurt your mom?
No. No.
In any way, shape, or form?
Nothing.
Did you have any arguments with your mom today?
I didn't say anything hurtful to her. I did nothing.
Left alone in the interrogation room for a moment, Jeffrey's vulnerability emerged as he quietly questioned, "Why is this happening?" With his head in his hands, he rocked back and forth, visibly distraught, frequently biting at his nails and fidgeting with the bandages. Following the interview, detectives visited Jeffrey's workplace to scrutinize the broken wooden pallet he claimed had caused his hand injuries. Attempts to replicate these injuries using similar materials proved unsuccessful, raising further doubts. With mounting suspicions against Jeffrey, and no evidence of an external intruder, he found himself arrested in connection with his mother's murder. On the 12th of October, Jeffrey was arraigned at Oakland County Circuit Court on a first-degree murder charge. Represented by defense attorney Jim Champion, Jeffrey pleaded not guilty, maintaining his innocence and asserting that Ruth's murder was the act of a disturbed individual, not her son. Defense attorney Champion sought bail for Jeffrey, emphasizing his clean criminal record and academic achievements as the valedictorian of his senior class. However, the prosecution vehemently opposed, citing the brutal nature of the murder. Prosecutor John Skrzynski asserted, "I don't care if he's the best and brightest. This particular act is a heinous crime." During the proceedings, defense attorney Champion informed the judge that Jeffrey's family, including both parents, stood united in support of Jeffrey. In response, the prosecutor cynically remarked, "Judge, I doubt very much that his mother stands behind him, since he murdered his mother." Consequently, Jeffrey was ordered to be held without bond in the Oakland County Jail, facing a potential mandatory life sentence without parole if convicted. As the courtroom drama unfolded, Bernard expressed his unwavering belief in his son's innocence to a reporter outside. His conviction in Jeffrey's innocence remained steadfast, leading to a tragic incident later that day. Bernard was alerted by his house alarm while at work, and he raced home fearing that his wife's killer had returned. In his haste, he was involved in a car accident, explaining to the responding officer, "All I could think was the guy who killed my wife was back in my house." Driven home by the police officer, Bernard found that everything was in order. Supporters of Jeffrey adamantly vouched for his character, asserting that he could not have harmed his mother. Many contended that detectives had arrested the wrong suspect, allowing the real killer to go free. Adding a layer to the perplexing narrative, the wife of Dave, their next-door neighbour, disclosed a noteworthy piece of information. She recounted witnessing a hooded figure walking the yards approximately a week before Ruth's murder. Firmly convinced that this mysterious figure was linked to Ruth's murder, she cast doubt on the investigative focus. In response, detectives dismissed these claims. They assured neighbours in a letter that they were not in jeopardy, and that Ruth's death was a familial matter, urging them not to be alarmed. Nevertheless, this communication did little to calm the community anxiety. Just like the Pine family, many others remained unconvinced that the killer had been caught. They all said that Jeffrey would have no motivation to kill his mother, that they both loved one another. However, as the narrative unfolded, revelations about the family dynamic emerged. Despite outward appearances of normalcy, the Pines grappled with pervasive mental health challenges. Tragically, Ruth's life had been overshadowed by these challenges. She had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which profoundly impacted every facet of her life. In the fall of 1998, the gravity of her condition manifested when she made threats of suicide, not only against herself, but also 7-year-old Jeffrey.
Well, first started back when I was 7. She was more depressed back then, like bipolar, you're depressed and manic.
Sure.
She was more depressed at that time for a few years, and then my sister was born in 2000, and she was good up until about 2008, right after I graduated high school, and she just went manic. It changed. She wasn't depressed anymore. She just got crazy.
As her struggles intensified, Ruth grew increasingly irate, withdrawn, and harbored unfounded beliefs that others were conspiring against her, resulting in her hospitalization. Under examination, a doctor diagnosed Ruth with bipolar disorder, characterized by manic and psychotic episodes. Prescribed medication initially showed signs of improvement, but these positive effects were fleeting. Ruth's behavior took a distressing turn, marked by unprovoked, prolonged laughter and alarming threats of self-harm. At times, she would exhibit peculiar behavior, including staring into the distance, making strange faces, and muttering under her breath. Despite having prescription medication, Ruth grappled with a religious obsession and hallucinations. These included the conviction that God instructed her not to take her prescribed medication. Whenever Ruth stopped taking her medication, her anger escalated, leading to outbursts directed at her children. In 2009, she was hospitalized twice, following incidents where she struck Jeffrey. Witnessing his wife taken away on a stretcher, Bernard was distraught, repeatedly expressing, "I can't believe it's come to this. She was doing so well." After her release from hospital, Ruth's religious fixation intensified, prompting Bernard to file a petition in July of 2010 to have her hospitalized again. He said that Ruth wasn't sleeping, had religious preoccupations and prolonged periods spent with the Bible, even in the bathroom. One of Ruth's hallucinations involved an invented religion that condemned all medication as a form of sorcery, leading her to outright refuse prescribed drugs. Non-compliance with medication exacerbated her condition, culminating in physical abuse towards Jeffrey and Julia. Jeffrey mostly silently grappled with his mother's mental health struggles, but once he expressed to a teacher his desire to help cure her. However, he never explicitly disclosed the extent of her mental illness. In one distressing incident, Ruth resorted to violence, grabbing Jeffrey by the throat during an attempt, alongside his father, to persuade her to take her prescribed medication. The escalation of Ruth's mental health struggles reached a distressing climax when she spat on Bernard's face, chased Jeffrey, hit him, and then strangled him.
I heard my parents yelling back and forth, and it woke me up. And I walked into their room because the door was open, and they were just screaming at each other, and she came at me. She launched out of the bed and grabbed me by the throat and like started hitting me and stuff. But I mean, she didn't hurt me or anything. It was just, she was manic. She wasn't herself.
Right.
So,
responding to the scene, the police observed red marks on Jeffrey's neck, leading to Ruth's arrest on charges of domestic assault and battery, a misdemeanor offense. In the bedroom, Ruth was found in bed. When questioned about the incident, her response was, "I plead the fifth." Bernard ultimately had to testify against Ruth in court,
You know, I don't want her to have to take medicine either, but it just seems like when she doesn't, all kinds of bad things happen.
A judge then imposed a $10,000 bond and issued a no-contact order with her son or their home. However, the judge later stipulated that Ruth could be released on a personal bond if she sought treatment at Haven Wick Hospital, a facility specializing in psychiatric and substance abuse care. Agreeing to these terms, Ruth underwent treatment, and the prosecutor ultimately dropped the charges against her. During Jeffrey's interrogation, questions centered on his mother's mental health. He revealed that she had started a new medication in September and claimed that since then conditions at home had improved. According to Jeffrey, his mother attributed all of her problems to his father, and aside from her resistance to medication, he claimed not to have any issues with her. Contrary to Jeffrey's portrayal of an improving atmosphere at home, the reality was a tense environment that had become so strained that Bernard was contemplating divorce. Despite years of efforts to keep the family together, the deteriorating mental health and the absence of improvement left him despondent. Jeffrey had confided in co-workers about the stress caused by his mother. Then in March of 2011, Jeffrey's stress intensified further when he and his girlfriend, Holly Freeman, parted ways due to him lying about meeting an old girlfriend. Jeffrey and Holly, who had initially connected on MySpace, had visited the Pine home together on multiple occasions. While Holly had a good relationship with Ruth, Jeffrey had shared the challenges of his mother's worsening mental health with her. He described his mother's odd behavior on bad days, strange laughter, talking under her breath, and racing up and down the stairs. Holly recollected some of the problems that Ruth faced.
She believed her medication was sorcery and witchcraft, and therefore it was evil. She had been storing knives in the headboard of her bed. She watched the religious channel, walked around with the Bible.
Detectives strongly suspected that Jeffrey was worn down by his mother's deteriorating mental health and reached breaking point. They believe that he feared for both his and his sister's safety in the household. Compounded by his recent breakup, detectives theorized that a heated argument with his mother triggered Jeffrey to lash out. Considering Ruth's history, another possibility explored was that Jeffrey had acted in self-defense. However, Michigan's legal landscapes don't recognize diminished responsibility as a valid defense. This means that prior abuse cannot be presented in court to demonstrate its impact on a defendant's ability to form criminal intent. Nevertheless, Jeffrey's defense could potentially use this information to argue that he suffered from mental illness as a result of the abuse he endured at the hands of his mother. Detectives scrutinized Jeffrey's alibi, which initially seemed solid. He claimed to be doing an odd job for a woman named Diane at the crucial time when Ruth was killed. Jeffrey often did odd jobs for Diane, and at the time, Diane was out of the house. When detectives spoke with her, she confirmed that Jeffrey had done some work for her, and he left her a voicemail.
Hey, Mrs. Ian, it's Jeffrey. I've been over to your house a few times since I thought you were coming home. I was just over there for about an hour or so, just kind of sweeping up, kind of checking things out. I was actually hoping you'd be there.
Diane confirmed that Jeffrey had moved lilac bushes for her, like he told detectives, but the timing didn't match up. Jeffrey had actually completed the task the previous Monday, not on the Friday when Ruth was killed. Furthermore, Diane said that when she got home, it didn't appear as though Jeffrey had done any work. She also added that Jeffrey never left her voicemails, something that stuck out in the detectives' minds. Step into the new year with a resolution to declutter and organize, and let Smart Labels be your guiding light. Say goodbye to the chaos of misplaced items and tangled messes. Welcome a world of order and efficiency with their cutting-edge app and QR labels. Simply purchase their color-coded smart labels from their website, qrsmartlabels.com, Amazon or Walmart. Then download the Smart Labels app from the Apple App Store or Google Play to effortlessly create a digital inventory of each box. No more lost moments searching for that one item you know you packed away somewhere and ensure that your New Year's resolution to be more organized becomes a reality. Embrace the future of streamlined living, where technology meets tidiness. Make sure to click the link in my show notes to simplify your storage organization today. Further probing into Jeffrey's life led detectives to his workplace and conversations with co-workers. The night before Ruth was killed, while closing O'Malley's bar with his co-worker, Nicholas Brady, Jeffrey exhibited signs of tension. He openly discussed his recent breakup and home troubles, revealing that his mother had once attempted to kill his little sister. Nicholas recalled Jeffrey's account of Ruth's mental health struggles, noting her paranoia, bipolar disorder, and the ongoing efforts to keep her on medication. Jeffrey also confided that his parents were contemplating divorce if the situation at home didn't improve. The following day, as Ruth's body was being discovered, Jeffrey appeared to be on edge and uptight when he arrived at work. His demeanor changed abruptly after receiving a phone call from his father, informing him of his mother's death. In April, Jeffrey returned to court, facing an order to stand trial. Judge Leo Bowman scheduled the trial for the 10th of September. Outside of the courtroom, defense attorney Champion addressed the media, acknowledging the challenges that Jeffrey faced, but highlighted his maturity in handling the situation. He refuted the prosecution's theory, arguing that the only evidence against Jeffrey was a cut on his hand and a strained relationship with his mentally ill mother. Jeffrey's father, Bernard, staunchly supported his son, and in May he organized a fundraiser to assist with his legal expenses. The event was arranged for the following month at Striking Lanes. Speaking about the fundraiser, Bernard said, "Everyone who knows Jeffrey understands he didn't commit this crime." Expressing the financial strain on the family, Bernard emphasized the daunting costs of confronting the government's unlimited resources with only middle-class means. The entire family, spanning both Bernard and Ruth's sides, attended the fundraiser, with Jeffrey's aunt Gail highlighting the significant financial burden. At the event, the family united in support, vehemently asserting Jeffrey's innocence and suggesting that the true perpetrator remained at large while Jeffrey languished in jail. The trial was then pushed back until November, when jury selection began. The jury was seated by the 16th and the proceedings were ready to begin. The courtroom was packed with friends and family, and they talked in hushed tones about what potential evidence the prosecution may have. During opening statements, prosecutor John Skrzynski wove a narrative portraying Ruth's mental illness and other factors as leading up to Jeffrey's alleged act of murder. Drawing a comparison to a mosaic or jigsaw puzzle, he told the jury, "This is like a mosaic, a jigsaw puzzle. But when you see the pieces, the evidence will show he is responsible." Prosecutor Skrzynski emphasized key pieces of evidence, including Jeffrey's false alibi and the injuries to his hands. He described the murder as an angry outburst resulting from years of living with a challenging bipolar individual.
"When the police came, there was no evidence of a break-in. There was no evidence of anything going on. As a matter of fact, Ruth's husband, Bernie, took an inventory of the whole house. There was nothing gone. Her purse was wide open on the dining room table. Nothing gone. Except, you thought a 2x4 in an obscure portion of the garage was missing. Ruth was not sexually assaulted. None of the windows were broken, none of the doors. As a matter of fact, the front door was deadlocked from the inside. Deadbolted. Later, when the police talked to Jeffrey Pine, he lied. He lied about where he was. He lied about what he was doing. He lied about how he got the blisters."
In contrast, defense attorney James Champion rejected the notion that Jeffrey was responsible for his mother's murder. Acknowledging the tragic nature of Ruth's murder, he argued that the evidence against Jeffrey was entirely circumstantial. His gaze moved from juror to juror, as he maintained, "Somebody else committed this crime. Nobody who knows Ruth Pine, and the question isn't whether he could have committed the crime, The only question is, did he? Devan's attorney Champion reminded the jury of the prosecution's burden of proof, clarifying that he wouldn't be arguing self-defense, insanity, or any other form of excusable homicide. He expressed his belief that the police had rushed to judgment in the case, challenging the foundation of the prosecution's narrative. The first witnesses in the trial included the 911 operator and the Pines neighbour, Dave Gilbert. Dave recounted the events of that fateful morning, describing how he took the cell phone from Bernard, who was on the line with 911. He testified that he was aware of Ruth's bipolar condition and her frequent refusal to take medication. Dave also mentioned a concerning incident a week earlier, when his wife observed an individual in a hooded sweatshirt cutting through yards. Though she reported it after Ruth's death, police reassured the neighbourhood that the incident was a family matter. Despite this, Dave remained apprehensive, installing new floodlights for added security. Nicholas Brady, Jeffrey's co-worker, then took the witness stand. The prosecutor presented photographs of wooden pallets stacked behind Spicer's and images of the injuries to Jeffrey's hands.
Do you handle pallets and boxes often, wooden pallets and boxes?
Yes.
A lot?
Yes.
Have you ever injured your hands doing that?
I smashed my finger between a box before, yes.
Mm-hmm. You get slivers ever?
Every once in a while. Mm-hmm. Not very often.
Let me just show you. I have the marked exhibits numbers 14, 15. Proposed exhibits 14, 15, and 16. I just want to show you these. And ask you if you have ever had injuries like this from lifting a pallet or working with a pallet.
No.
During his testimony, Nicholas shared details of conversations with Jeffrey, highlighting his emotional distress. On one occasion, Jeffrey had conveyed his concern that his mother might eventually pose a threat to his sister's safety. Following Nicholas's testimony, William Cartwright, a farmer at Spicer's Orchards, took to the stand. On May 27th, Jeffrey arrived for work around 3 p.m. with bandages on his hands, claiming he'd injured himself throwing pallets. William found this explanation odd, as the injuries didn't resemble those from handling pallets, but rather looked more like somebody entered a batting cage without a glove. William observed that Jeffrey, who was typically talkative, was unusually quiet that day, a behaviour he associated with his mother upsetting him. Oakland Deputy William Sale, the first officer at the crime scene, provided detailed accounts of the post-murder search conducted by him and fellow officers. During cross-examination, defence attorney Champion accused them of mishandling the investigation. He pointed out that there were incomplete records and the absence of proper protective gear during the initial sweep of the home. The officer's failure to wear protective gear raised concerns about potential contamination of the crime scene. Paramedic Amy McIntosh, who pronounced Ruth dead, testified about Jeffrey's reaction upon learning of his mother's death. She described his initial cries and moans, but noted the absence of tears when Jeffrey stood up. She found it unusual, and it raised suspicions of possible acting on his part. Deputy Ronald Chatterson took the stand to discuss the knife confiscated from Jeffrey during his police station interrogation. He confirmed that Jeffrey hadn't attempted to conceal the knife. During cross-examination by defence, Chatterson addressed the question of whether it was typical for a murderer to return to the crime scene with a knife. He confirmed that this wasn't typical. Deputy Chatterson and various detectives consistently noted that in the hours following Ruth's murder, Jeffrey displayed an apparent lack of emotion. Detective Stephen Stradowski emphasised the stark contrast between Jeffrey and Bernard's reactions. He described Bernard as despondent upon receiving the news that his wife had been murdered, while Jeffrey showed minimal emotional response. He testified. He put his hand up to his face, wiping away tears that weren't there. While acknowledging that people respond differently to trauma, the detectives highlighted that Jeffrey's reaction was not normal, especially considering his ability to function, which is uncommon for someone in shock. Gary Bonham, an EMS worker at the scene, echoed similar observations. He noted that Jeffrey collapsed to the ground and made sounds that sounded like crying, but there were no tears. He testified, "It looked like he got up and thought, well, now I've got to get back in the ambulance because I'm done putting on a show." Detectives also testified that there were no signs of forced entry into the family's home. The focus then shifted to blood evidence, with Detective William Foreman discussing Ruth's blood found on the taps. Despite the common tendency for those who knew the victim to clean up the crime scene, forensic evidence linking Jeffrey to his mother's murder was notably absent. No murder weapon was discovered, and Ruth's DNA wasn't found on any of Jeffrey's clothes or the knife confiscated from him at the police station. The garage also lacked fingerprints or footprints, and the DNA found in the blood solely belonged to Ruth. The prosecution then introduced the pallet on which Jeffrey allegedly injured his hands. They said that no blood or tissue was found to support his claim. Dr. Terry Melton revealed that hair found inside Ruth's hands had a profile matching either Ruth or one of her relatives. The absence of forensic evidence connecting Jeffrey to the murder raised questions about the prosecution's case. To reinforce their narrative, the prosecution then called Kip Conley, one of the Pines' neighbours, as the next witness. During his testimony, Kip stated that Jeffrey's vehicle was present at the Pine home less than an hour before Ruth was discovered dead, placing him at the crime scene around the likely time of the murder. The narrative then shifted to cell phone data, with Detective Jerry DeRosia testifying about Jeffrey's cell phone records. He said that the received call section of Jeffrey's cell phone was empty, a detail that he deemed as being unusual. The trial's focus then turned to Jeffrey's alibi of planting lilac bushes at Diane's home. Diane testified that he had completed this task on May 23rd, contrary to Jeffrey's claim of doing it on the 27th. She expressed fear for Jeffrey upon learning of Ruth's death, explaining, "Ruth had expressed such strong opinions. I was afraid that Jeffrey had been engaging in some behaviour that set her off." Donald McKinnon, Diane's neighbour, corroborated her testimony by confirming that Jeffrey wasn't at her home on the day Ruth was killed. The jury then heard from Holly, Jeffrey's ex-girlfriend, who described him as sensitive and stated that he never exhibited any anger around her. She emphasised that Jeffrey never retaliated with violence even when his mother attacked him. Holly revealed that Jeffrey struggled profoundly with his mother's mental health, sharing a moment when he confided in her, saying that he couldn't endure the situation any longer. This testimony provided a nuanced perspective on Jeffrey's character and his relationship with his mother. According to Holly, Jeffrey was afraid of leaving his sister at home alone with their mother, something that she herself agreed with.
"I did not think it was a good idea for Julia to ever be left alone with Ruth in the house."
Holly also shared her perspective on Bernard, describing him as a jerk. According to her, Bernard was tough on both Jeffrey and Julia, displaying a hot temper that made Julia hesitant to practice piano in front of him due to his harsh criticism. Holly also presented her own theory on Ruth's killer, implicating Bernard. She initially suspected him based on the belief that Bernard wanted Ruth out of his life. Jeffrey had also told her that if his mother and father were to divorce, his father didn't want to pay alimony. Additionally, Jeffrey had informed detectives about Bernard seeing another woman and having an affair on his mother. However, Bernard had a corroborated alibi. He was at the restaurant during the critical time, and although the pathologist couldn't pinpoint the exact time of Ruth's death, Jeffrey had told detectives he saw her shortly before he left the home at 1:30 p.m. Bernard's presence at the restaurant was confirmed from 11:45 a.m. until after 2 p.m, dismissing the suspicion that he could be involved in Ruth's murder. After an extensive four-week trial, the proceedings culminated in the delivery of closing arguments. The prosecutor candidly acknowledged the circumstantial nature of their case, but asserted its substantial strength as very good circumstantial evidence. As Prosecutor Skrzynski addressed the jurors, his gaze traversed from one to another, emphasizing a stark reality, as he said. Their house was clean, a neighbor told you. But there were problems inside, and it was not what it appeared to be. With conviction, the prosecutor characterized the case as one marked by overkill, perpetrated by an individual harboring some sort of relationship with the victim, Ruth. Pointing to Holly's testimony, he stated, "He told Holly, 'I can't take it anymore,' and he felt helpless. Helpless about a vicious cycle at home and her refusal to take medication." Drawing attention to Jeffrey's hand injuries, he asserted that they resulted from wielding a 2x4 wooden panel. The prosecutor also didn't shy away from highlighting what investigators deemed a feigned reaction to the news of his mother's death, telling the jury, "He pretends, because he already knows what happened, but he does this little act so people won't be suspicious." In contrast, defense attorney Champion, during his closing arguments, hammered home the central theme that the case rested solely on circumstantial evidence. He scrutinized the investigative process, casting doubt on its rigor and adherence to protocol. He bluntly reminded the jury, "They didn't take any time going through the garage or that house. Why not? They were sure they had their guy already." In the arena of legal discourse, two contrasting narratives clashed. One sought to establish guilt through interpretation of circumstantial evidence. The other challenged the detective's integrity, imploring the jury to cast doubt on the prosecution's narrative. The jury were then sent off to deliberate.
"In the people of the state of Michigan versus Jeffrey Pine, we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of second-degree murder."
Jeffrey Pine was ultimately found guilty of the second-degree murder of his mother, Ruth Pine. As the verdict was announced, Jeffrey shook his head slightly. As he was escorted out of the courtroom, he turned to his father and mouthed, "I'm okay." Outside of court, Bernard spoke with the media.
"I'd like to say that there's been no measure of justice served for my wife, for my son, or for my family. There's no evidence tying my son to this crime, and there's a good reason for that. He didn't do it.
And he maintains he's innocent.
He is innocent. People who are innocent don't say they're guilty. I want to say this, that he was convicted on a story that was based on hunches and speculation. Somewhere in the mix, the presumption of innocence and the definition of reasonable doubt was lost. I can't explain that. I know that I know my son is a tender heart, and I'm telling you right now, he did not commit this crime. His mother's illness made him an easy target."
Ruth's sister, Linda, also said to reporters, "My sister was a victim. She wasn't the monster the media portrayed her as. She was a victim." The sentencing phase followed on the 29th of January, but before then, one of the jurors called up Jeffrey's attorney and expressed regret for the decision to convict him. Defense attorney Champion referred to this as splitting the baby. He said that the jury clearly had enough doubts that they didn't convict him of first-degree murder, but since they weren't sure what happened, they convicted him of the lesser charge. During the sentencing phase, it was apparent that Jeffrey's family still stood by his side. Ruth's sister, Susan, read aloud a letter from her mother stating, "He is a good boy, and I do not believe he did this." Bernard also read aloud a letter from Julia, Jeffrey's sister. She wrote what a good big brother he had been, and asked for him to come home soon. However, Ruth's other sister, Linda, said she believed that Jeffrey was exactly where he deserved to be. She shared her belief in his guilt, adding that she wanted him to come clean so that he could get the help he needed. Bernard touched on this and said that Ruth didn't have any kind of relationship with her sister Linda. He said he wasn't sure why she now seemed concerned about Ruth. Bernard then read aloud his own victim impact statement. He asked that his son come home as soon as possible, to be with his family where he belonged. Jeffrey was allowed to read aloud from a letter he had written, thanking his family and supporters. He maintained his innocence, stating, "I hope that someday the truth may be known and I may be acquitted." He then added, "I ask that you consider the facts presented at trial. A complete absence of evidence that connects me to this crime. My family, especially my father and sister, want and need me home so we can begin to move on and heal from this tragedy." Before handing down the sentence, Judge Bowman said he received numerous letters and cards from people who supported Jeffrey. He said some argued that there was a lack of evidence to convict him, but he disputed that. He highlighted in particular the time frame in which the crime must have been committed. He stated, "Crucial in this case was that the window of opportunity for any other individual to have committed this offence was approximately 45 minutes to an hour. The jurors in this case were satisfied with the people's theory that no other person entered the house in this case and committed the offence. They were satisfied that it was Mr. Pine. I can't say that the jury was wrong." Jeffrey Pine was then sentenced to 20 to 60 years in prison. To this day, the public remains sharply divided in their opinions regarding Jeffrey Pine's guilt. Some perceive him as a killer who cracked under the immense strain of caring for a mentally ill mother. Others staunchly believe in his innocence, contending that he is a man wrongly convicted of one of the most heinous crimes imaginable, the murder of his own mother. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Melissa. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way. If you'd like to join me up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In exchange for your support, I upload ad-free and early release episodes of Morbidology, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, videos, and case files, and I also send out some merch along with a handwritten thank you card. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. I really do appreciate the feedback and love to read your comments. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.